This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Ariel Fernandez lives in Florida, and he's pre-ordered a Rivian SUV.
I'm willing to invest in this company and basically put my trust in them that they're going to make me happy.
You'll hear about how the reasons Rivian buyers want the vehicles don't always match up with the company's marketing of the outdoor experience. And Eric Stock talks to one of the candidates hoping to succeed Alderman Diana Howman on the Bloomington City Council. Plus, a closer look at why some colleges are going to stop asking their applicants about their criminal histories. All that after a GLT news update. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Since the day Rivian first arrived in Normal, there have been questions. Who are these guys? Are they really going to buy the Mitsubishi plant? Are they legit? Now, as Rivian pivots toward sales and production of its first two electric vehicles, it's a new question. Will people actually want to buy them? I spoke to several people who've already pre-ordered the Rivians about why they jumped in. When you watch Rivian's promotional videos, their electric vehicles are always speeding across the beach, winding through a forest, or heading to some sort of adventure. That's not Steve Smizek. He lives in Columbus, Ohio, with his wife and two kids, works on the corporate side of retail. Today, they're using a big old GMC Yukon for school drop-offs, soccer practice, and the occasional road trip.
And, you know, you look at that thing, and I'm getting maybe 15 miles to the gallon, and it just seems wrong.
Smizek just pre-ordered a Rivian R1S SUV, one of two all-electric vehicles that will soon be produced in Normal.
I know that these vehicles are being built for doing a lot more engaging off-road type activities. That's probably not something where we're playing with too heavily, but I think just getting into something that could be fun to drive, looks great, you know, has the EV upside to it, and you know, for my wife, never having to fill up with gas again would definitely be something she would appreciate.
Bloomington Normal leaders expect Rivian to provide a huge boost to the local economy once it begins production of its first EVs in 2020. Rivian has promised to bring hundreds of jobs to the Normal manufacturing plant formerly occupied by Mitsubishi in exchange for millions of dollars in local and state tax breaks. But before any of that, Rivian needs customers. Customers like Smizek. Smizek follows the EV industry and heard whispers about Rivian before, but it wasn't until their LA Auto Show debut last month that he actually saw Rivian's first vehicles. Smizek did some research and eventually plopped down the $1,000 deposit for the SUV.
It was just kind of fascinating to buy their story and, you know, kind of how long they've been kind of figuring themselves out of what they want to do. Product looks fantastic. They really seem to have their ducks in a row in terms of what they want to do. And, you know, with the factory that they've already purchased and the product looking as good as it does, it looks like they're off to a great start.
Rivian spokesperson Michael McHale declined to disclose how many pre-orders they've received for the R1S or the companion pickup truck called the R1T in the past couple of weeks. In an email, he would say only, quote, "it's easily exceeded our best expectations," unquote. Speaking of expectations, some were surprised by Rivian's price tag. The SUV will start at $72,000, the pickup at $69,000. That's before any federal or state tax incentives. More expensive models with larger battery packs will be produced first. Those prices are not yet known. The price was the biggest sticking point for Scott Preston. The Normal town council member pre-ordered the SUV too.
There's certainly a chance that, you know, once production actually begins on these vehicles in 2020, that I may end up being priced out of the market, you know, and they very well could be more than I'm able to spend on a vehicle, you know, once we get to that point.
But Preston says he felt comfortable pulling the $1,000 trigger because the deposit is refundable.
That kind of ease of cancellation is something, especially because, you know, production won't begin until 2020, and there's a lot of time between now and then. That's something that gave me more peace of mind.
The price really wasn't a turnoff for Ariel Fernandez. He lives in Coral Gables, Florida. He pre-ordered the SUV, too. Fernandez says yes, the Chevy Tahoe and the GMC Yukon SUVs out there are cheaper, starting at around $49,000. But there's a trade-off.
But you're also talking about a car that you're going to have to put a lot of money into gas. In this case, it's electric. We're going to be saving a lot of money on the fuel, and it's something that we're doing to help the environment.
Fernandez, who works in business consulting, says his concern for the environment is a big deal. His family recently put solar panels on their home near Miami. But functionality was also important. Fernandez says he was impressed by the battery life and range of Rivian's vehicles. The version of the SUV with the largest battery pack will be able to travel over 410 miles on a single charge.
We travel a lot in the state of Florida. And sometimes outside the state of Florida, we own a place in Tennessee, and we sometimes drive up there. So something with a longer range than 250 miles was important to us. Just getting to Orlando sometimes can be, 280, 290 miles.
He also has a three-year-old son who, like most kids, comes with a lot of toy-related baggage.
Anytime that we travel, we need the space. And the cargo space on the R1S was substantially larger to the Tesla. So that was something that attracted us.
That Tesla he's referring to is the Model X, one of the few fully electric SUVs on the market. But more are coming. Kia will launch two electric crossover SUVs next year. Byton's M-Byte SUV launches in 2020. It's famously difficult to launch a new car company, even in an EV market that's expected to grow rapidly in the next decade. Other EV startups have flamed out, like Faraday Future. Even market leader Tesla has struggled to deliver on time. Fernandez said he'd never heard of Rivian before its reveal at the LA Auto Show. So was he worried that Rivian will be able to deliver what it's promised?
You always take risk in these cases, and it's something that it's a calculated risk. But it's something that I'm willing to take because I see the product that's out that they're putting out, and it looks like a product that I'm definitely willing to invest in. The price tag is a little high, but I'm willing to invest in this company and basically put my trust in them that they're going to produce the vehicle and make me happy when I pick it up.
Steve Smizek, the buyer from Ohio, says he knows Tesla's success is the outlier, not the norm.
I stay pretty followed up on information in terms of looking at it. And if I got nervous, I would probably pull that deposit. But I have to say, after researching the company and just seeing the measured pace at which they're moving, I don't feel like this is a flash in the pan, low likelihood of making to market. This seems to be very planned out. I think the auto executives on that team that they've, brought in from other companies know what they're doing. And it smells like something that could be successful.
Rivian's plans to build its vehicles in the U.S. is another selling point for Fernandez. During an interview with GLT, Fernandez was already well aware of the normal manufacturing plants up and down history with Mitsubishi. He says he's happy to see Illinois getting an economic boost from Rivian recycling the plant in this way. Fernandez's grandparents were Cuban immigrants. From his grandfather, he inherited a Buy American mantra when shopping for a car.
Sometimes the Japanese vehicles and the Korean vehicles are a bit cheaper. But we always make the investment in the country that accepted our family and where we live.
Scott Preston, too, wanted to support what Rivian was doing locally.
And I love that they are not only doing things here, but that they're also in a very innovative space and an innovative industry, looking at the all-electric SUV and truck.
Preston's new Rivian SUV will become his primary day-to-day vehicle around town.
Unless something incredible changes in the next 2 years, we won't have any beaches or mountains in Bloomington Normal.
Smizek, Fernandez, and Preston may all have slightly different reasons for buying a Rivian, but one thing they have in common, it'll be their first electric vehicle. You can follow all of GLT's coverage of Rivian, including reporting from the LA Auto Show, at our website, wglt.org/Rivian. Later in the show, GLT's Eric Stock sits down with one of the candidates hoping to succeed Alderman Diana Howman on the Bloomington City Council. But first, this is an important moment for this public radio station. We're in the last few hours of the GLT Fund Drive. Here to tell you more about that is my newsroom colleague, Mary Cullen.
So today is the last day of the GLT year-end fund drive and your opportunity to help pay for programs like the 21st Sound Ideas and Here and Now is slipping away. So head on over to WGLT.org and make your contribution now. I'm Mary Cullen. Here in the studio with me is Mike McCurdy.
When it comes to the fund drive, better late than never is better than not at all. But why leave us hanging? We use your money to help pay for your favorite shows. You know you're going to pledge. It was on your mental checklist yesterday, but you didn't get around to it.
So stop putting it off. help keep us on track to meet the goal, which is raising enough money to help pay for all of our shows, streams, and podcasts. Maybe a better phrase for Fund Drive is never put off till tomorrow what you can do today. You've heard us talk about the cost of the programs GLT airs, but there are behind-the-scenes expenses too. We have to pay for things like microphones, mixing consoles, audio recorders, and computers.
There are also the engineers who keep the station running and the tech wizards who make sure that all of the national programs come to you without a hitch. There are satellite dishes, audio lines, and internet streams that allow us to connect to you and connect you to the world. There's the station vehicle that keeps the GLT news team on the go.
These behind-the-scenes expenses add up quickly. And like everything else, these expenses go up every year. The only way we can keep up with all the costs of bringing you the public radio service you rely on is with listeners' financial support. That includes yours, so please contribute now.
You can do that at WGLT.org. You've heard us say GLT is listener and user-powered. That means financial support from listeners like you helps pay for the programs that enrich your life and the lives of those around you every day. Help power this public radio station that you and your community depend on with your contribution right now. Click on donate at WGLT.org to support the essential local and regional news every weekday on Morning Edition, Sound Ideas, and All Things Considered. The GLT News Team brings their long experience and deep community roots to the interviews and features you hear every day on Sound Ideas.
You not only depend on the GLT News Team for thorough, responsible reporting on local events and issues, you also share their interest in local history. You can count on them to show you interesting local art and culture events, and you appreciate how they help you get to know people making a difference in the community.
GLT's local news service is important, it's valuable, and it's unique. That's why you use it every day, and that's why you need to support it with your contribution at WGLT.org. If it's time to renew your annual support for GLT, you can get that done right now by going online. You might even consider increasing your annual investment to GLT. Every dollar you can spare will help offset the ever-increasing cost of bringing you what you expect and deserve. Give as generously as you can at WGLT.org.
Lots of listeners choose to contribute monthly because it's so affordable. Just break down your annual donation into small, easy-to-handle monthly amounts. It's easy on your budget, but it still makes a big difference for GLT's budget. Contribute $10 a month or more, and we'll thank you with a pair of snazzy GLT socks. Support your public radio station with your ongoing monthly contribution now. Head over to WGLT.org right now and make your contribution.
You can make a one-time contribution using any major credit card or ask us to bill you. You can make automatic monthly contributions using a credit card or deductions from your bank account. Faculty and staff at Illinois State University can use payroll deduction to support GLT. Choose your payment options when you click on donate at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from the Community Cancer Center, proud to provide community-based cancer care with the help of more than 100 volunteers, many of whom are cancer survivors who are well-equipped to support patients. Information at cancercenter.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. About 8 people have died every month inside Illinois prisons over the last couple of years. IPR's Shannon Heffernan has been trying to learn about their deaths. One of the things she's found is that some of the deaths are the result of poor prison health care. And she's found that the Department of Corrections doesn't track even basic information on the people that die in their custody.
Sheila Fain's son Desmond died when he was just 30 years old. He had a heart condition since he was little, but as long as it was managed, he was okay. So when he died in prison, Sheila wanted to know what went wrong.
I called and they would tell me that they couldn't talk to me. One while the nurse was willing to talk to me, and then all of a sudden I called her back. She couldn't talk to me.
She was still trying to get details about her son's death when, about a year and a half later, she got a call about Earl. Earl was her nephew, but she'd raised him alongside Desmond like a son. The caller told her that Earl had now died in prison.
I asked, was she effing serious? That's the only thing you can say. Are you effing serious when you've been through this before?
Earl was just 26 years old and had always seemed healthy. Earl was in prison for murder and had a long sentence. Desmond was there for a gun crime, and she'd expected him home again one day. Both deaths were hard, not only because of the loss, but because she couldn't get information about what exactly happened.
Not had the information is like not having a closure.
For several months, I've been trying to track how and why people in Illinois prisons are dying. I got a list from the Department of Corrections with 166 deaths in the last 2 years. But about half of them have no cause of death listed, including Earl, the nephew Sheila raised. I used an open records law to request info about Earl's death. But the department said they didn't have the records. No medical examiner's report, not even a death certificate. Sheila didn't have very much info on Earl either. I'll come back to Earl. But first, Sheila did have some information on her son, Desmond. And I thought documents I had might be able to fill out the picture. But I wasn't sure, so I drove to see her in Freeport, Illinois.
Hi, I'm Shannon.
Six other family members showed up. Sheila said she wanted them there in case things got emotional. We all piled in the living room together. Sheila showed me a t-shirt she made.
I love this one right here in the middle. That's why I put it in the middle.
The shirt is a collage of three different photos of Desmond, showing his three different sides.
This is what you call when him was happy. To me, this is his more serious side.
You guys laughing because did he always have a serious face on? Is that
the difference between the pictures must be something only a mother can see. His happy face and his serious face look the same to me.
But when he cracked the joke, he still was serious about it.
Do you have any pictures of him smiling?
There he is, right there.
That's the only one.
That's probably his last smile.
When he was like 8?
So Sheila was wearing this t-shirt one day at the restaurant where she works, and this guy came in to eat.
And he looked up and he said, "Who is that?" I said, "That's my son." He said, "I was locked up with him when that happened." I was like, "You was?" I said, "Do you know anything?"
If he knew something, he didn't say. But other people who were in the prison did reach out. One wrote Sheila a letter. She has her daughter read it to me.
"I'm a friend of Desi's. He always told me things. He was not getting the proper medical help he needed by the doctors at Sheridan. He filed grievance to know."
Letter says basically that the prison let him die.
"Peace be with you, Desmond friend."
This information matched Sheila's suspicions, but it wasn't proof. It wasn't details. And that's what Sheila wanted. She shows me a binder she has of the information she's gathered.
"But it's so much crossed out, you can't make heads or tails of it. You can't."
It's difficult to follow some of the records with redactions, but combined with other paperwork, it creates a timeline. A timeline that matches with the record I have.
"So it's patient number 2. He's not named, so I'm not sure it's him, but it really sounds like him when I'm reading it."
"The patient was about 30 years old. He had..."
This record is from a court report. It was recently filed in a lawsuit over prison health care. It was written by an independent medical expert who reviewed the prison's healthcare system after being appointed by a federal judge as part of the lawsuit. He examined 33 different prison deaths, then wrote detailed reports about what happened for each one. The cases are all anonymous, but one of them, patient number 2, the details match with Desmond perfectly.
"See the death date here?
That is him.
The date he died, the prison he was in, his heart condition. Everything.
You can put a name there. It's Desmond Lee Fang. You can put a name there. There's no way you know that this is..."
Sheila scans the report quickly, trying to take it all in, and then goes through more slowly, sentence by sentence. The report describes what happened to Desmond, showing error after error after error being made by healthcare staff. For example, Desmond was preparing for a surgery when he was sent to prison. A letter from his doctor was in the prison medical record, but the doctor was never contacted and the surgery was never done. The prison also gave him a medication that can have severe side effects given his condition. And the report says there's no clear reason for even prescribing it. The report says the prescription may have caused or at least contributed to his death. After reviewing the case, the medical expert determined Desmond's death was preventable.
"He didn't get the death sentence, but in the long run, they gave him the death sentence."
So over his 6 months of incarceration, they identified 10 different times they made errors.
"If one person dropped a ball and somebody pick it up, that's different. But you continue to keep on dropping the ball, showing and telling me as a mother that my child's life did not matter."
"Not what they wanted from me."
"Yeah, you got his life.
The money they get.
You took my son away from not only me, you took his brothers and sisters, you took him from his family. You have people every day saying they miss my son. You have people at holidays, we can't spend no more holidays with him. We can't see him on his birthday. We can't see him no more. Yeah, he did a crime, but he was paying for his crime. I don't know what the future would have held for him, but you took that from him. You took it from us."
The independent expert found that a third of the deaths he examined were preventable, just like Desmond's, and noted that medical staff made egregious errors, some so egregious, the report says it would typically result in a doctor needing to be evaluated and possibly have their license sanctioned. That report is part of a lawsuit brought by the ACLU of Illinois and Uptown People's Law Center, alleging healthcare in the state's prisons is so bad it violates the Constitution. As for Earl, the nephew who Sheila raised, I was able to confirm with the coroner that he died at age 26 of pneumonia. That matches with what the hospital told Sheila. But as of now, we don't know much more. We don't know if his case was preventable, like his cousin's. We have made multiple requests over months and months to talk to anyone in the Illinois Department of Corrections about how they track deaths, how they investigate if something went wrong. But the department refused all our requests for interviews. I'm Shannon Heffernan.
This is Sound Ideas. Coming up next, why more colleges are going to stop asking their applicants about their criminal histories. It's another story from the Illinois Newsroom. But first, it's an important day here at GLT, the last day of the year-end fund drive. Here to tell you more about that is Mike McCurdy.
It's also your last chance to show your support for Sound Ideas. You can make your contribution at WGLT.org. I'm in the studio with Mary Cullen.
There are a lot of answers to the question, what is Sound Ideas? It's the show you're listening to now. It's where state, regional, and national newsmakers stop by. It's where you stay up to date on issues and events that impact our community every day, and it's where you connect with local artists, writers, and musicians.
It's the flagship GLT News program. It's the show that occupies a lot of thought and time to prepare. And you're saying things to us like the show is great and that recent episode featured great interviews, all of them.
If compliments were cash, we wouldn't be on the air asking for more money. Running a public radio station is expensive. We're only asking for you to take a small piece of one show. Help support Sound Ideas on GLT with a pledge.
We're wrapping up this fund drive today. This is your last chance to let us know how important Sound Ideas is to you with your contribution at WGLT.org. We know you want to do it. You've been meaning to do it. You're going to feel guilty if you don't do it, so don't put it off any longer. Just click on donate at WGLT.org. Now, if you're trying to decide whether or not to support GLT, just try thinking back to the news you just heard. Most likely it was comprehensive, intelligent, maybe even inspiring, like Ryan Denham's report on likely Rivian buyers.
Every time you tune in, you learn something. Maybe you're even inspired to do something. The news, the essays, and the conversations here are valuable to you. That's why you make room for GLT in your day.
And that's why you need to make room for GLT in your budget. Everything we do for you depends on your financial support. So think back to the stories you just heard and make the right decision. Contribute whatever you reasonably can right now at WGLT.org.
When you use MasterCard, Visa, Discover, or American Express to pay your pledge to GLT, your money goes to work for the station almost instantly, helping pay for the excellent public radio service you demand. You can charge your one-time contribution or set up an ongoing monthly contribution right now at WGLT.org.
And when you set up that monthly contribution of $10 or more, you'll be eligible to receive a pair of those really cool GLT socks. Gathering news is not cheap. GLT reporters need more than a microphone and digital recorder, transportation, wire services, computers, production studios, engineering support. They're all essential to GLT's award-winning local news operation.
Covering our community is expensive, but with your help, we can stay on the beat, bringing you the local news, conversations, and feature reports you need and expect. Support your source for local news with your contribution now at WGLT.org.
Everyone who signs up as an ongoing contributor at $10 a month or more gets a pair of the brand new GLT socks. Contributing monthly is a great way to fit your support into the your support for GLT into your budget. You'll make a real difference for GLT's cash flow, and you'll get to show off your love for public radio with your GLT socks, all for just $10 or $20 a month. You can get started at WGLT.org, and that's also where you can see the socks.
This fund drive ends today. This means it's your last time to submit your contribution online at WGLT.org. Thank you.
Support for GLT comes from ESA, Eye Surgical Associates, providing innovative treatment and vision-correcting surgeries for a wide range of eye conditions, including cataracts, macular degeneration, diabetic retinopathy, and glaucoma. You can see the difference at eyesurgicalassociates.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Next year, the common application used by hundreds of colleges and universities will stop asking potential students about their criminal histories. But despite legislative efforts in Illinois, most campuses in the state continue to ask that question. As Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gaines reports, just seeing that question on a college application can discourage people with criminal records from even applying.
4 years ago, Chris Miner sat down at his computer and started his application to the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And that's when he saw the question. It asked if he had a criminal record.
This is all done online. And I just sit there and stared at the screen for like 10 minutes. It was like everything, every advancement I made so far might be over with. Maybe this is the end of the ride.
So, Miner lied on the application, and he was accepted. He didn't disclose the fact that in the early 2000s, he was arrested, convicted, and sent to prison for stealing thousands of dollars from a Domino's pizza he worked for. Once Miner started at the U of I, he opened up about his past. He started speaking in public about it and volunteering with organizations that help formerly incarcerated people. Then he decided to apply for a graduate degree at the U of I.
So I'm filling the application. Of course, it's late at nights when I do my best work. And then I came across the question. And yeah, there were tears. I cried. But it was upsetting because I've achieved this at your university. I've given you money. I was on the dean's list. Every semester I've been there, I graduated. And you're still going to ask me this? You're going to ask anyone this?
This time, Miner was honest about his record. And he was accepted again. But there's a lot of people who don't get as far as Miner did. A 2015 study found that an estimated two-thirds of people with felony convictions who started applications to the State University of New York dropped out of the application process in part because of having to provide information about their criminal records.
There's no evidence that says because Illinois asks these questions that we're safer.
That's Barbara Wheeler. She's a conservative Republican in Illinois' House of Representatives who's tried for the past 3 years to pass legislation that would prevent public universities and colleges from asking the question. So, what's getting in the way? While she's managed to pass it in the House, the bill has stalled in the Senate, and that's largely because nearly every public university in the state opposes the legislation. Despite Wheeler's assertions, Aaron Woodruff says the bill is a threat to student safety. He's the campus police chief for Illinois State University.
Specifically in the areas of sexual violence, my major concern with this bill is that we cannot prevent somebody who's been accused, convicted of sexual assault at another institution. That individual could then apply to ISU or to any of these institutions, not have to disclose that, and the university can't use that information to prevent that individual from attending.
There's not a lot of research on this, but what's out there tends to support Wheeler, the state lawmaker. There's no conclusive evidence to suggest that asking about an individual's criminal history during the admissions process decreases campus crime. Wheeler said she's also heard the concern about sexual violence from parents in her district.
I have four daughters, and I hope all of them go through the state program. And if I thought for a second that my children would be in danger because of what I'm doing, do you think I would really do it? Of course I wouldn't.
Proponents of banning the box on college applications say the question is doing more harm than good, and the impact is especially profound for people of color. Because blacks are disproportionately represented in prisons, they're also disproportionately affected by policies that ask about criminal records. That's something Chris Miner worries about. He's the formerly incarcerated student at the U of I, and he's also white.
As soon as I got in, I was elated, but not long after, it's like, well, how many people didn't go through with this process? Or did other people, maybe a different color or a different background, did they mark the same answer as I did and get rejected? It's still ridiculous, and that's why I'm still fighting against them, and hopefully that question won't be around much longer.
Proponents of the legislation say they're going to continue the fight, too. They say they'll renew their effort to ban the box on college applications after the state's new Democratic governor, J.B. Pritzker, takes office. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
His story was produced with support from the Education Writers Association Reporting Fellowship Program. Illinois State and Illinois Wesleyan Universities asked the question, saying they believe it's important to know past criminal histories of potential students. The two institutions both say such a history is not necessarily a disqualifier. This is Sound Ideas. Now turning to the 2019 election, Travis Wilson says he wants to be a voice for change in the Bloomington City Council. The former city firefighter and paramedic manages McLean County Emergency Medical Services System. As part of GLT's series of interviews with candidates for city and town offices next April, Wilson tells GLT's Eric Stock he believes in a limited role for municipal government.
I'm a Bloomington Normal native. I was born and raised here, graduated from Cornerstone Christian Academy. And this is a community that I've learned to love over the last 30 years of my life. And I want to see it continue to be a successful city and community. And right now, I don't feel like we're heading in the right direction. And I think public service is a important thing to for people to participate in. And so this is how I want to be able to serve my community, is by leading some change for the positive and continue to grow our community in the right direction.
And what part of your background do you feel makes you a good fit to serve on the council?
So I served as a firefighter paramedic for the city of Bloomington. Right now, I don't do that. I'm an EMS system manager, so we oversee EMS in, throughout a couple counties. But I've been able to respond to all of the city and see people at different times and different needs and really be able to get a feel for what's happening in the community. I had a unique perspective that a lot of people don't have and haven't had the opportunity to see. And I think that allows me to truly empathize with people's needs and what's happening and be able to serve them better.
You talk about the need for change in the city. What specific changes do you feel need to be made?
So right now, fiscally, our city doesn't seem to have a solid footing. We've balanced the budget based on raising taxes and adding fees. But if that was my personal budget, I wouldn't be able to go to my boss and just say, hey, you know, we're short. I'm short this month for some money. Can you here's a new fee for you for me showing up to work. That's not how things should work. We have to be able to balance what we have. And that means making some tough decisions. They're not easy decisions by any means, but somebody has to take a stand and say, this is what we're going to have to do to in order to effectively use our taxpayers' funds.
Are there certain items within the budget that you feel could be limited or curtailed entirely to avoid taxes at a level that you feel is too high?
Sure. Some of the things that I would want to focus on is maintaining our infrastructure and public safety, so police and fire. And then looking at other services, we might have to scale them back a little bit for the time being in order to get to better footing. Some of those might be garbage service. We're one of the few communities in downstate Illinois that has our city-funded garbage service. So do we start looking at privatizing that, contracting that out? Those are just things that are on the table to look at, looking about ways to maybe change how we deliver certain services in order to effectively use that dollar.
Now, Bloomington does have several big projects on the horizon of the coming years, but projects that have been consistently put off because the funding isn't there, such sure. as a library relocation or an expansion at its current site, replacing O'Neill Pool, which is aging, we'll put it that way,
sure.
and also improving infrastructure. The council was considered raising taxes and adding a new gambling fee to help pay for this as one way. Now, you've already said that you're against that, but would you be agreeable to anything that would enable these projects to happen, or do they just sort of remain on the back burner until somehow the money becomes available?
So let's take the library, for instance. I think a library is an important part of the community. It allows access to education that some people may not have access to at their homes. But at this time, again, we don't have those sources, and we can't continue to raise taxes and tax the citizens until they have nothing left. So we have to look at ways of, do we start creating basically like a micro library in different parts of communities, almost like a small park, in order for citizens to access books and computers and digital media and those ways? Do we start looking at ways to basically reducing the footprint of the library where it's at and spreading that out? those are some things that, you know, talking with the people in charge of the library, you know, are those effective? But at this time, I don't think it would be appropriate for us to approach and the city and the citizens and say, hey, we got to raise taxes more for a multi-million dollar library.
Could these micro-libraries, or I guess satellite locations that you're referring to, can that be done in a more cost-effective way?
It might be, and that's something you can look at with partnering with organizations that have space already in different locations throughout town that are willing to say, hey, yeah, we're here for the community. We want to open those doors to people so that they can come in, receive services, are able to access that material in their location without having to try to get across town or whatever challenges that might hinder them from coming to that library.
Bloomington and Normal officials have examined a proposed multi-sports complex for the Twin Cities, something that they say would require a significant private investment because the two communities don't have the money for it, but they do see the economic benefits of it. How much of an investment do you feel comfortable with the city of Bloomington to provide if it were to be the last piece of the puzzle for the project to happen?
Very limited. I think if somebody thinks that there is a good economic outcome for them to build this place, that they would come here and build it themselves. Right now, sports numbers, youth participation in sports are continuing to dwindle each year. It's not anything significant right now, but it's dwindling. So why are we going to invest in something that it's not on the rise?
Now, there is a need for a new soccer complex.
Sure.
Because the one out near Central Illinois Regional Airport will eventually have to move because of FAA guidelines. So anything that should be done there, or do you consider a piecemeal approach or just leave it to the soccer community to figure it out?
I think we can assist in helping guide that. I think there's plenty of spots in town that are vacant currently that we could utilize for soccer fields. Looking at those approaches and saying, how can we partner to utilize this land that's being underutilized right now? It's a lot better to have a beautiful soccer field on those empty spaces rather than just showing an empty blank field.
Grossinger Motors Arena has been costing taxpayers ever since it opened, and the full extent may not even be known after the alleged financial schemes that were going on there over a period of years. Its supporters, though, say the losses are negated by the positive economic impact. What kind of oversight should the city provide for the venue, and are there other options that the city should explore to manage the financial costs involved?
I don't think the city should necessarily be telling them how to manage it. That's not our expertise, but the city should definitely be involved with how money is being spent. That's our money that we're spending right now, and currently we're hemorrhaging a decent amount every single year, and the city needs to take ownership in that. They can't continue to let this ship sink and hope that it's going to fix itself.
How would you propose they do that, and could there be options such as either selling it or whatever else?
The option of selling it would be fantastic. I don't think anyone was going to want to buy it just because it doesn't offer the opportunities for investment. The return of investment is going to be very minimal. So that's the challenge. We have this massive sinking ship in the middle of our downtown, and we got to figure out how to deal with it.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with Travis Wilson, who was a candidate for Bloomington City Council in the spring elections for Ward 8. Bloomington had explored a so-called welcoming ordinance in the past year to provide some legal protections for the families of undocumented immigrants. Mayor Terry Renner, though, had pulled it, saying that there wasn't going to be enough support of the council for it. He instead authorized the police chief, who had just been appointed, to implement this policy that would essentially do that. Were you satisfied with how this issue was handled and anything that could have been done differently?
I think the focus of the city council should really be, it's pretty limited. It's on our economic, or how we spend our tax money, I should say. And when we start getting into social ideas like that, we tend to get distracted and lose focus. If somebody has concerns about how immigration is being handled, I hope they approach that at the state and federal levels where they can really make an impact. But for city elections, our city council focuses, we should really be looking at how are we spending our tax money? Are we doing it wisely? And are we benefiting our taxpayers?
How would you define the city's relationship with Normal? Could it be better? Should it be better? And to what extent should the two communities work together on economic development and consistency of regulations? And could that be done better?
So the last few years has been a little bit rough. There's been a few instances where the city in Bloomington and Town Normal had disagreements. I think overall our relationship's decent. And there are a lot of areas that we work on well together, but there are areas that we can work on better together and work on ways to streamline how we utilize our resources. Economic-wise, it is vitally important that we work together. If an employer comes to Normal, that's going to affect Bloomington. If an employer comes to Bloomington, it's going to affect Normal. And so when it comes to economic development, that should be a team play right there.
Do you feel that there are specific ways that they should be working together better in that realm?
Streamlining some resources would be good, maybe garbage services, water services, looking at different ways that we can cut down on some of those costs. I think Bloomington Normal already has a lot of different partnerships going and are working well with that. There are always going to be some differences to overcome, but I think good communication teamwork is going to overcome some of those deficits.
The Bloomington City Council in recent years has been a very deliberative board. They've had their share of conflicting viewpoints, as we talked about with the welcoming ordinance that never happened. And that's caused legislation to, in some instances, get bogged down and go nowhere. Where's the right balance between having a diversity of opinion to fully represent the diversity of the community while still passing legislation and still getting the business of the city done in a timely manner?
Yeah, that's one of those things that you're going to have to sometimes put away pride and understand that you're going to have to work with people. The council is going to have diverse views. I don't share the same views as everybody on the council. And so I can't just come in there and say, this is how we're going to do it, because it won't go very far. So it's working with each other to figure out that common middle ground and how to approach that best. Right now, my job, I work with 43 different fire and EMS agencies with very different backgrounds. And so in order to implement a policy, I have to work with all stakeholders in order to make sure that we're all in agreement with what our plans look like. And so I have to bring that to the city council.
And one of the outgoing members of the city council, one who you're looking to replace, Diana Hallman, has called for nonpartisan elections, nonpartisan governing at the local level. Now, they technically are, but she claims a party ideology is more so creeping its way into municipal elections. And she says that's a bad thing. To what extent has political ideology made its way into municipal government, and is that a concern?
That's always been an underlying thing, I think. Everybody has their political leaning. I think at this level of government, those social issues that a lot of people would like to hold on to really aren't affected by what decisions are made on the city council. So focusing back on to the simple task that we have, which is providing a good use of fiscal policy to our citizens and delivering those services that are essential for our community. If we focus on those and stop ignoring or start ignoring all those other side issues and those distractions, I think the city council can come together and overcome a lot of those differences.
That was Bloomington City Council candidate Travis Wilson with GLT's Eric Stock. Wilson is running against Jeff Crable in Bloomington's Ward 8. Donna Howman is not seeking re-election there. You can hear interviews with Crable and other city and town council candidates right now at WGLT.org. You're listening to Sound Ideas, and that means you care about this community. That's what this GLT year-end fund drive is all about. And you're running out of time to contribute. Just a few hours left. Here to tell you more is my newsroom colleague, Mary Cullen.
So we're in the last few hours of the GLT's year-end fund drive, and it's time to quit thinking about contributing to help pay for some programs and actually do it. Here with me in the studio is Mike McCurdy.
We know you're not listening to GLT to hear us beg for money. You're here for the news, the conversations, and the stories NPR and GLT bring you. So you put up with us interrupting to ask for your financial support, knowing that soon we'll get back to the content.
And that's okay, but listen up. We're here bugging you for a very good reason. The content you're you're waiting for is only possible because some people respond to our requests for a financial contribution. Listener dollars pay for GLT and NPR News. Without listener support, there is no GLT. It's time to be a responsible listener. Help pay for the content with your first-time contribution right now. So you're listening to this fun drive and you're wishing it would just end already. You want to listen to Sound Ideas without these darn interruptions. Well, we're here to tell you that's not a very smart wish.
Wishing this fun drive away is basically wishing away GLT's most important source of funding, contributions from listeners like you. Remember, GLT doesn't have income from 20 minutes of commercials every hour. Instead, your public radio station pays for the programs you depend on with contributions from people like you, people who value the independent, balanced news and entertainment GLT brings you every day.
So stop wishing the fun drive would end. It's like wishing GLT would go away. Get involved instead. Make your first-time contribution right now and then start cheering us on. Contribute now at WGLT.org.
Now, if you've never contributed before, maybe you're wondering how much you should give. The answer is whatever amount you can. Some people contribute $25 a year. Others contribute $25 a month. Every contribution, no matter how much, pays for the GLT News and NPR programs you depend on. So don't worry, just give what you can. Click on donate at WGLT.org.
You do more than listen to GLT. When you tune in to Morning Edition or TED Radio Hour or Sound Ideas, you're engaged intellectually and emotionally. GLT keeps you informed in a manner you just can't find anywhere else. You get the latest news, sure, but it's reported responsibly with the information you need to form your own opinions. We see to it that you're entertained, too, introducing you to storytellers and musicians you might not have discovered otherwise.
When it comes down to it, you can only say what GLT means to you and why you continue to tune in day after day. And only you can say why, up until now, you've never contributed to help pay for all of the programming you rely on.
You have a choice as to what media you use every day. You choose GLT, but you don't choose to support on the programming that you love. There's a disconnect there that only you can fix. Make your contribution now and be fully engaged, not only as a listener, but as a supporter of WGLT.
When we asked new contributors what moved them to finally decide to financially support GLT, most of them say the same thing. They realize they get something of value here, so they feel like they should put something back in. You get something of value from GLT. That's why you're listening. It's time for you to put something back and make your first-time contribution. Your contribution helps pay for Sound Ideas and our recent coverage from the LA Auto Show. GLT's Ryan Denham was in LA for the debut of the two Rivian vehicles. And I'm just curious, Ryan, Ryan's here now. I'm just curious what it was like sort of being in that huge media pool, because this is a show that's sort of designed not only for people interested in autos, but also for the media.
Absolutely, yeah. I felt very lucky being there, honestly. I'm sitting in the media room at the show, and right behind me is the big LA Times booth. They've cordoned off part of the room. Reuters, Car and Driver magazine, all these other organizations, and you know, we're the littlest guy there in terms of a small public radio station from Illinois. So it was very cool. I felt very lucky.
And how did Rivian treat you with the same sort of gravitas that they treated the LA Times or Reuters?
I think so. I think that they realize the importance of what they're doing in our community and how invested the community is in their success. And, you know, we're an important conduit for them in terms of getting their message to our community. And then on our side of it is, you know, holding them responsible for some of the promises they made and to make sure they're living up to those promises.
So they recognize that we're sort of telling their story here in Bloomington Normal.
I think so. I think that they've been very respectful, easy to get a hold of, easy to get sources and interviews. Yeah.
Okay. Ryan, thanks for your coverage. And I think our listeners appreciated us having the only reporter in LA to cover that. I'm Mike McCurdy in the studio with Mary Cullen. It's the GLT Fund Drive.
So this fund drive is all about asking you to help pay for the service that gives you the information you need to help you make better decisions, develop more informed opinions, and really have a more connected life. It's all about asking you to support the music you love and the intelligent conversations you crave. It's all about reminding you that without listeners' financial support, there is no GLT. So please contribute now.
We'd like to say thanks to everyone who's already contributed this year. Hundreds of you have renewed your support and even made extra contributions to help preserve the programming you depend on. But if you have not contributed yet, please do so now. You can't rely on others to pay your share. Because if everyone did that, there would be no GLT. So come on, decide how much you can give and click on donate at WGLT.org.
You count on GLT. You count on the news and the analysis. You count on the commentary, on the conversations. You count on music and entertainment. So count on us and make your donation right now at WGLT.org and be a fair contributor to WGLT.
Thank you for choosing Sound Ideas today on WGLT Normal. WGLT.org is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Eric Stock, IPR's Lee Gaines, and Shannon Heffernan. I'm Ryan Denham. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and NPR One. Mostly, we want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Comment on our Facebook page, we're WGLT-FM, or follow us on Twitter. We're all at WGLT News, and I'm at Ryan WGLT. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.